Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harvey Kay is with us in our Milwaukee studios. He has a new book, and a good one it is, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. He's the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and author of the wildly popular Thomas Paine and the Promise of America and a number of other books. He writes that we need to remember now, after more than 30 years of subordinating the public good to corporate priorities and private greed, of subjecting ourselves to widening inequality and intensifying insecurities, and of denying our own democratic impulses and yearnings, we need to remember who we are, the children and grandchildren of the men and women who rescued the U.S. from economic destruction in the Great Depression and defended it against fascism and imperialism in the Second World War. Hello, Harvey. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. In fact, I came down from Green Bay because I would not miss the opportunity to be in studio with you.
Oh, how nice. I'm so glad. And you brought your wife, too. It's great to see you. You're a really fine writer, but you write about these periods of inspiration. You're an inspirational writer, and there are times when we need to be inspired, Harvey.
This is one of the times we need to be inspired. We see a politics of obstructionism on the right and a politics of moderation, if not deference, too often on the left. And I think that in a patriotic sense, we have an obligation to our parents and our grandparents, those who came through the 30s, came through the 40s, made this nation the strong and powerful nation it was after the war, and between the 1930s and the 1960s, extended and deepened freedom, equality, and democracy as no other generation in American history did.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the four freedoms, and there's a chapter that begins with four Jewish soldiers who were in World War II, and also with an African-American soldier, what was striking to me was that the promise of his four freedoms was something that carried those soldiers, it carried the African-American soldiers, it carried, I don't know if it's going too far to say a war effort, but it was in people's minds, this is why we're fighting.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because most historians, if you read them, they say that Americans really didn't know what the war was all about. They couldn't recite the four freedoms when asked, that, you know, it wasn't as clear as many of us would have liked it. But my work showed just the opposite, that first of all, when Franklin Roosevelt spoke the four freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear in January 41, he wasn't doing this out of thin air or even just out of his own imaginative head. He was putting into words what Americans for 8 years in the 1930s had been struggling to achieve. They didn't achieve it all, but they accomplished extraordinary things in the face of the Great Depression. So that as they entered the war, and when he spoke those four freedoms, they grasped it in their diverse in many ways, and knew that this was not simply a war to defend those four freedoms and what they'd accomplished, though it was that. It was also a war that would enable them to then go back and do even more to enhance American democratic life. And that extends from, indeed, the question of freedom of speech and expression, which was not only the ability to speak, but also the ability to organize labor unions, to organize consumer campaigns, to organize civil rights movements. I mean, one of the things about American history that I think is so fascinating is that we are, more than most intellectuals allow, a fairly exceptional story in that when we confront crises, our way of beating them, of transcending them, is not to suspend what we're about. I mean, we're not perfect. We're not saints. I mean, every generation is filled with its racists and other folk. But somehow in the days of the 1770s and the days of the 1860s and then in the 30s and 40s and beyond, we confronted crises by making America even freer, more equal, and more democratic. It wasn't easy. It wasn't simple. But that's what we did. And that's what we can do again.
Well, part of it, and this ties into some of what we were talking about with the Earth Movement, Earth Day in the 1970s, was this bottom-up, wasn't it? So FDR was walking into a climate where you had people who had been in World War I who were victims of the Depression. They didn't have any money, and they marched, and they went to Washington, D.C., and they went to New York City, and they made their point.
They turned out. They spoke. And that's what Roosevelt wanted them to do. In 1935— he actually he told, I believe it was a consumer rights group, but it was some group that of reformers, and he said to them, laws, new laws in themselves do not make a millennia. Do not make a millennium. And what he meant by that is that we can pass laws, but the fight continues. In fact, the fight is even tougher to make sure those laws are not just recognized, but fulfilled. So, for example, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which was later found constitutional in the Supreme Court, it guaranteed, but it didn't automatically lead employers to say, oh, yeah, we're going to recognize labor unions. The battles really began then to make sure they did recognize, and it required bottom-up action by labor organizers and working people and the support of the federal government. And needless to say, the giant corporations did everything they could to resist it. Everything they could to resist it. I'll make that clear.
Yeah, tell me more about that resistance, because I think our memory, we forget that there was massive resistance to some pretty remarkable things this president was doing.
Absolutely. I mean, when Roosevelt first came into office, there was an effort to work cooperatively with big business. And yet they realized pretty quickly the top 1%, we'll use our term, the top 1%, that the Roosevelt New Deal and the popular aspirations that it sort of brought forth, that basically that was a threat to what the governing elite, the ruling class of that day was about. It meant that America would not be simply a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. Catholics and Jews would be equal to the elite Protestants. It meant that working people would have a say in their working lives. It was called industrial democracy. It meant that housewives, for the first time ever, there's this massive housewives movement in the 1930s demanding some kind of regulation of prices in the face of the difficulties of the day. Not unreminiscent of in the 1700s when homemakers would go into the marketplace and demand prices as they called a moral economy. Civil rights groups in the 1930s began to mobilize in the South against terrible odds, facing the likelihood of everything from burning crosses to lynchings. But there and in the North, African Americans organized. It was probably the greatest democratic surge ever. Well, the top 1%, they didn't like it. And they were organized in the National Association of Manufacturers. We call them NAM. They were organized in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Still two very powerful organizations. And then the most elite of the elite organized something called the American Liberty League and spent millions and millions of dollars trying to persuade Americans that the New Deal was somehow either fascist or communist. And most Americans rejected it, and the American Liberty League disbanded after the devastating defeat that conservatives took in the 1936 elections. But the top 1% was determined then, and I think if we look at American history ever since, to do what they could to contain, if not suppress, those ideals that we've come to know of, or at least come to believe in, as the Four Freedoms.
So how did his privilege, FDR's privilege, play into this? Because he was one of them, really.
Oh,
he wasn't one of the working class.
Right. He was definitely one of them. And in fact, as many people say, he was a traitor to his class. Well, he grew up in the Hudson River Valley of New York, above New York City. What a beautiful area it is. And he grew up on an estate. And he's a Roosevelt. But he was in the Democratic side of the Roosevelt family, as opposed to Teddy Roosevelt, who was one of his heroes, who was a Republican, though a Republican who became a capital P progressive. So Roosevelt himself enters politics as a Democrat. And in New York State at that time, there was the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, a tragedy which challenged politicians of the day to do something about regulating the sweatshop industries and others. He also himself knew of the problems of upstate farmers. Roosevelt always had a primary interest in agriculture. And in the course of his adult life, he confronted politics as a Democrat, as what we would later call a liberal Democrat. Some people, the woman who eventually becomes his labor secretary during the New Deal years.
Frances Perkins,
a remarkable, uh-huh, extraordinary woman, first woman cabinet member ever, and of all things, Secretary of Labor. She shook up the labor movement quite a bit. Well, I mean, she wrote a book, her memoir of her work with FDR, and she said that knowing him as a young man and then knowing him as a matured man, she saw a dramatic difference in his in how he viewed the world around him and how he viewed the needs of working people and others who needed supports. And she attributed the change to his having suffered, he suffered polio, mm-hmm, from 1921 on. And she believed that it was that experience which altered his understanding of what we need to do for each other, either both individually and, you know, cooperatively and collectively. But she also granted that Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, played a remarkable role in educating him during the 1920s to the needs of working people in New York City, because she got involved in the Women's Trade Union League and other groups in New York, and she herself became friends with quite significant Eastern European immigrant Jewish labor organizers. Mm. And she would bring them to Hyde Park or to the other homes they had in the Hudson Valley, and he would get to talk to them. And that made him all the more aware of the needs of working people. He was already educated to some extent. He had been the assistant secretary of the Navy during World War I, and he had to work with labor unions. So he was not oblivious to the needs of working people. But apparently, the bout with polio and his education by Eleanor and the people he met really did have an impact. But there's something else I should point out. And this is the thing. We should listen to this in all of our politicians. How do they understand American history? Franklin Roosevelt had an extraordinary sense of American history. He didn't see it as something that just happens. He says the things that we've secured, the things we hope to secure, they require struggle. He actually referred to American history as a perpetual revolution. You know, democracy doesn't stand still. And over and over again, he makes it a point of acting on that by inviting Americans and engaging Americans to take part, as I said earlier, in the struggles, in the movements to make the laws that he's hoping to initiate and carry out, to make them all the more real, to make them all the more real on the ground in people's everyday lives.
It's interesting that as you were saying that, I was thinking of how you start the book so eloquently with the children and grandchildren that we must remember what they did at that time, too. It's not that long ago, but what's happening to us? We're not remembering
what's happening to us
as deeply as we should.
What's happening to us? You know, when I first had the idea for this book, I'll give away a secret here. I really wanted to write about the Four Freedoms speech, because I was really impressed by Roosevelt's speech making. And I was especially impressed, to refer back to the Thomas Paine book, by the fact that Roosevelt was the first president since Thomas Jefferson who not only quoted Thomas Paine, but actually used his name in speeches.
Interesting.
And I thought, you know, I got to look a little more closely at these speeches of his. So I looked at a speech writing team. I looked, and all of whom said that the great lines were always Roosevelt's in his speeches. And so I talked to my editor, and I said, you know, I've got this great idea. How about if we do a book on FDR and the Four Freedoms? And he came back and he said, you've got to answer a question. What happened? What happened? What have we forgotten? And especially said to me, you know, make it FDR, the greatest generation, and the Four Freedoms. Talk about it in terms of what we Americans, who are the children and grandchildren of that generation, may well have forgotten about what our parents and grandparents accomplished. And it just clicked. Because I had written before about my father in the 1990s, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to send a thank you note to that generation, but also a challenge, I hope, to our generation and to the generations coming up behind us.
And part of that, not to get to the end too quickly here, and we want to not be at the end, we want to be more back in that generation, but you really nail it toward the end of the book that you even have a Democratic president, you had him have a House and a Senate that were Democratic, and what happened to the moment and those huge ideas and sort of carrying on and remembering what it was to be a liberal Democrat and taking your moment in history, taking your time to do something big.
I assume we're talking about the current administration.
Yes.
When you say that. You know, maybe you recall that in 2008 during the campaign, there were actually magazine covers that had these images of President-elect Obama adorned with Franklin Roosevelt attire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was talk of a new deal. Conservatives were so worried about a new deal that they started saying, oh, we're a center-right nation and this president shouldn't push too far too fast. And I remember thinking, they're worried. They know. A new deal means Americans wake up, Americans get involved, we reconstruct the nation. Not simply economic recovery, but reform and real reconstruction. Okay? And I thought, well, this could be good. I was skeptical, but I thought this could be great. And you know, I mean, we all followed closely what was happening for the healthcare plans and other things. And all of the folks out of Washington kept saying, you know, he's just not articulating it well. He's not putting it in the right terms. And this was, you know, this was a lament because this was a president who has phenomenal oratorical skills. I mean, this is a president who's one of the smarter guys we've probably had in the Oval Office. But the one thing he didn't seem to grasp, which Roosevelt did, is that point of the that point is new laws in themselves do not make a millennium, that you have to engage Americans in this activity. You have to bring them in. You know, I said to my students up in Green Bay in 2008, because you could see they were like chomping at the bit to go to work, and these are my upper division students, and I said, you know, this is great. And I'll tell you, if I were President Obama, if he should be elected and get into office, first thing I do, whatever else needs to be done about banking and healthcare, first thing I do is I would include in any massive bill a massive internship program so that every high school graduate and every college student, if they wish to serve an internship a year or two in some kind of Civilian Conservation Corps operation, and we can come back to that given Earth Day, Civilian Conservation Corps, National Youth Administration, there are all these wonderful programs. I would do that, and I would create opportunities for young people on a grand scale to see the country, do good, okay, and figure out how together, in a kind of new form of solidarity, you can redeem the best of America and honor our parents and grandparents at the same time. And my students said, oh, what a great idea. I hope he does that. I hope he does that. It never happened. Yeah. And in fact, I'm convinced that the 2010 debacle on the part of the Democratic Party, which we continue to suffer from, that the biggest problem wasn't actually the health care plan. That the biggest problem was that Obama failed to mobilize people behind that health care plan. I mean, labor, whatever our reservations, and I belong to two unions, whatever our reservations were about what has come to be called Obamacare, Obama should have called out labor, consumer, civil rights groups, to occupy the public square before anything known as the Tea Party turned out. I mean, that was the moment. So there were so many ways he could have mobilized Americans. In December of 2012, after he won election, I sent an open letter. I put it on, it was at salon.com. I said, an open letter to head of the AFL-CIO, Brother Trumka, Richard Trumka. I said, Brother Trumka, this is the time for labor to take the lead. Organize a new March on Washington. Don't wait for the anniversary of the March on Washington. Remember, the March on Washington was about jobs and freedom. Let the labor movement lead the new March on Washington back to Washington, D.C., if only because we need to push our president. We need to give him the encouragement he needs that labor and other groups gave Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s.
And talk about mobilization. You could have sent him a lot of information about what FDR had to do to mobilize millions of people to join a war effort that they weren't even convinced was a very good idea. There was a strong isolationist tendency. Talk about grassroots mobilization. My goodness.
Yeah. Roosevelt, but I'm convinced that that was his sense of American history. And we make a big mistake if we don't teach an American history that tells young people about what it took to make the things that they take for granted. And Roosevelt somehow grasped that. He actually tried to write history himself. After World War I, he ran on the Democratic ticket for vice president, and they were defeated. It was a League of Nations question, and the Democrats backed Wilson's League of Nations. The Republicans opposed it, and the Democrats lost, and they were going to lose for the next 12 years. Well, Roosevelt went back to Hyde Park, and he decided he was going to do what his heroes had done. His heroes were Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and they were both known as really good history writers. Teddy Roosevelt better, though. I actually have real reservations about Teddy Roosevelt. He made some nasty remarks about Thomas Paine that I have a hard time forgiving him for. But anyhow, Wilson and Roosevelt, the elders, really were his model. And I think he imagined that if he was ever going to become president, if he was ever going to get near the presidency, he had to make his statement, some kind of public statement in the writing of history. So he sat down to write, and he didn't get very far. No. He discovered he was not a writing man. But he really did have something to say about American history. And fortunately, he found his way of doing so in his speeches. And he really did, in that fashion, transform our understanding of America thereafter. So, for example, the 1920s, when the history books talked about Thomas Jefferson as a radical Democrat. They meant small d Democrat. They meant it was because he opposed big government. He wanted limited government. Roosevelt looks at Jefferson and says, no, no, we're misreading Jefferson. The beauty of Jefferson's democratic spirit is that he had a certain kind of confidence in the average common man. Well, in Jefferson's case, farmers. Okay, he believed in sort of popular agrarian movements. In fact, Jefferson was the one who said, in every generation, we need a little rebellion in America. So, and Roosevelt appreciated that, and that became his model of a president. That was his understanding. And for what it's worth, I'll mention that through the 1930s and the first two terms, Roosevelt did everything he could to change the image of Jefferson as a limited government guy and make him more of a real sort of populist Democrat. Mm-hmm. And of course, we get the Jefferson Nickel and the Jefferson Memorial that comes a bit later. I mean, Roosevelt had an appreciation of history and an appreciation of historical memory, and he wanted to cultivate it.
We welcome phone calls. I have a feeling you're going to get more than a few here. Our guest is Harvey Kaye, and Harvey's latest book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Harvey's been with us before, and we liked what he said so much about Thomas Paine that we reran that show several times because you liked it as much as we did. He is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America and a number of other books. His father served in World War II, and my father did as well. So if you don't mind, and we're going to indulge in just a little bit of reminiscing, too, because I think that if you have personal connection with this generation, and, you know, we'll be gone eventually here, too. So you got to listen to what we have to say because we have the memories and they are profound. So we'd love to hear from you. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. To you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harvey Kaye is our guest this hour. His latest book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And let's go to phone calls. Brad in Whiting is our first caller. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. The media today pushes the false equivalency meme that both the Republican and Democratic parties have become extreme and obstructionist. And I think that's true for the Republican Party, but nothing could be further than the truth for the Democratic Party, especially if you examine the language that they use today and their appeasement to the right wing versus the language that FDR used, talking about economic royalists and the bankers and welcoming their hatred versus Hillary Clinton giving a talk to Goldman Sachs a couple weeks ago, telling them they've been misunderstood, and Goldman Sachs gave her $400,000 for her speeches. So if you could talk on that, and maybe a little bit of Henry Wallace, who I'm a big fan of, his vice president.
Okay, so first, let's deal with the difference between past and present Democrats. Franklin Roosevelt had extraordinary confidence in his fellow citizens, something I don't feel resonates at all from the current crop of Democrats. Mm-hmm. So in 1930, in the middle of the Great Depression, Roosevelt exclaimed to a really good friend, in fact, in a letter he said, you know, given everything that we're seeing around us, it's time to make America fairly radical for a generation. Now, that's a pretty good statement coming out of a prospective presidential candidate. Got to make America fairly radical for a generation. Now, he only said that because he truly believed that his fellow citizens would understand that required progressive action. It didn't mean destruction. It meant progressive action. It meant rebuilding the country. It meant affording relief to people. It meant pursuing an economic recovery that didn't leave out the forgotten man. It meant reforming the nation so that working people had voices. And as his antagonists organized against him, he took that as a compliment. He took that as a sign that he was doing the right thing. And you're right, he did go before the Democratic Party, 100,000 delegates and their families in a stadium in 1936 in Philadelphia, and he said, you know, the economic royalists, They complain we're trying to overthrow American institutions. And then he said, what they really are worried about is we're trying to overthrow their power. And then his punchline was, and we are. I mean, this was a president of the United States running for re-election, and a re-election he would win handily, historically. And the way he spoke to his fellow citizens is that we are citizens and we will not be dictated to by the 1%. Mm. Okay? He didn't go off to try to hug and kiss those who were going to come after him. He said, as you said in the Madison Square Garden speech later, he said, you know, I welcome their hatred. You know, even now I'm beaming. If there was a TV camera, I'm beaming just to think about that possibility of a president saying that. And yet today we find presidents, ever since Jimmy Carter, talking about austerity, talking about, you know, cooperation with business, about affording them opportunities to invest. Well, I think anyone who looks at American history knows that if you want to make America better, if you want to make America stronger, if you want to make America more prosperous, then you empower the folks that Roosevelt thought of as the forgotten folks. You empower working people. You don't empower those who already have power and wealth. They've already got it. They're obviously doing something wrong with it if we're in the trouble we're in now. Now, Henry Wallace, out of Iowa, a wonderful agronomist, and came to Washington as the Secretary of Agriculture in the 1930s, and real serious mistakes were made by the Department of Agriculture during that time. But one thing that they did very right, really right, is that when they wanted to help farmers recover, they didn't just give aid and subsidies. They actually organized farmers themselves to be a part of the decision-making in agricultural reform and agricultural growth. And what Wallace knew that Roosevelt knew is you don't work simply from the top down. You have to involve citizens. You have to mobilize citizens and gain their, not just their support, you want to gain their energy as part of the program. Now, Wallace became his vice presidential candidate in 1940, and they won presidency and vice presidency together. That is Roosevelt and Wallace. And during that war, Roosevelt pretty much licensed Wallace to go out and give a really remarkable speech in which he said that we are going to create not simply the American century, we're going to create the century of the common man. And what he meant is we're going to make an even freer, more equal, and more democratic America. Wallace himself had problems as a candidate, and he antagonized a lot of people. And the Democratic Party really did push on Roosevelt to bring Truman in as vice president in 1944. But that's a whole separate debate. And Wallace later runs on the progressive ticket, which was probably a mistake. I know I'm going to alienate a lot of folks on the left when I say that, but Wallace had a lot to offer, and unfortunately, in the midst of the Cold War, a lot of people who had a lot to offer got marginalized.
Thank you, Brad, very much for the call. Let's go back to the Civilian Conservation Corps and some of these other programs. You write about, which is a fairly dramatic thing to do, first year and a half after he's first been elected, passage of an extraordinary body of legislation, extraordinary, some of which works, some of which doesn't work very well, but he carries on. So let's talk about that which worked and how people embrace this. We're talking dramatic things in this country.
The one thing that really the thing that worked that we all now have a vague recollection of is the CCC that you referred to, the mm-hmm. Civilian Conservation Corps. This was something that he had tried experimentally as governor of New York. For the sake of fighting soil erosion, planting trees, and so on. And then he comes to Washington, and he brings this team of people with him, and the first 100 days are, you know, I don't think they even sat down during the first 100 days. And then this continues on and on. And one of the things about those experimental first 100 days is you're right, many a mistake was made, but they saw America as a grand experiment. So if you make mistakes, that's okay. You try something new, okay? And that they garnered a lot of sort of popular support just for that alone. Well, the Civilian Conservation Corps at first actually frightened people because what he had in mind was taking, you know, hundreds of thousands of young, working poor men, you know, late teens and early 20s, and sending them out across America to CCC camps out in farming belts, out in, you know, rural areas, out in the countryside. and with the idea that they were going to help farmers. It happened here in Wisconsin, fight soil erosion. They were going to plant trees, go up to northern Wisconsin, if you like, go all around the country. They built parks. I mean, they built campgrounds. It was an extraordinary thing for the couple of, for the 2 million young men who took part in it. But locals were afraid. They thought, uh-oh, we better protect our daughters from these urban types who could have been these Catholics and Jews and others. You know, this was okay. But within a short period of time, they embraced them because they realized that these were decent young Americans. There's nothing to be afraid of. And in fact, the men who took part in this, the boys, if you like, and men who took part in this, they discovered what it meant to be an American. Their health improved. They were educated. You know, speaking of Earth Day, I'm just going to point out, there's a really, I forget the name of the author of the articles, but there's a really good argument to be made that the origins of the environmental movement, as opposed to the conservation movement, which have earlier roots, actually is in the 1930s. If you send 2 million young urban men around the country to do good for the environment and they succeed, they come back with an appreciation of that environment that they carry with them beyond the war that most of them are going to fight in into the 1950s and into the 1960s. Not surprising. Let's think about the 60s once again. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, all of the acts that fulfill the 1930s CCC experience, perhaps, and then the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, again, that's that generation from the 30s all the way through. And we could talk about other grand experiments, some of which, you know, we think less of, like we think less often of. But the WPA up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, is a really nice park, Pamprin Park, beautiful lodge, beautiful bridge over the Duck Creek. It was built by a combined effort of the CCC and the WPA. In fact, you go to any number of Wisconsin small towns, and there's a post office, and go to the cornerstone, and you'll see it was built, you know, by the Treasury Department. here in Milwaukee, I think if you drive up the lakeshore and you're heading up towards the UWM campus, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus, and you look down over towards the lakeside, there's that large campus-looking building. It's a water treatment facility. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's WPA, I'm almost sure. And if it's not, it's the PWA, its counterpart, the Public Works Administration. I mean, so much of what we even see, we may even be walking on sidewalks that were originally built by the WPA. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but I'll stop.
Let's go next to Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just thinking about how much the Republican Party has changed from the time of Lincoln, when Lincoln said there is no capital without labor, and people like Teddy Roosevelt, who took on the huge interests of timber and mining interests to create the national parks. And then even Nixon, who passed the Clean Air Act. And then we get to Ronald Reagan, and I believe Ronald Reagan changed the four freedoms to take away freedom from want and freedom from fear and substitute freedom of enterprise, which I think is what the Republican Party seems to represent now. Like, and Jefferson talked about, the Founding Fathers talked about having political leaders that were disinterested. But now I think what we have, especially with the new Supreme Court ruling, is these people who are very interested. Like in our state, in the last legislative session, they tried twice to pass a law taking away local control so that sand mining interests could sort of have their way in Wisconsin. And I think that this idea of government that serves the general welfare, you know, like in the preamble of the Constitution, or even the well-being maybe is a better word, because people get hung up on the welfare thing. But just to have a government that's working for the best interests of the people, and I don't feel like we have that now.
Harvey.
Yeah, well, first of all, you might be entertained to know that in around that same 1930 mark, we need to make America fairly radical for a generation, that Roosevelt wrote to the historian Claude Bowers, a great historian of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, and they had become friends. And he said to Bowers, you know, given the way the Republicans are behaving, I think we ought to lay claim to Lincoln as well for the Democratic Party. And I love that line. And I have so many more things I could say. And in fact, when war came, World War II, Franklin Roosevelt actually did embrace Abraham Lincoln as his model of a wartime president. Mm. But let me also then jump to Ronald Reagan. You're absolutely right about Ronald Reagan. Now, he started out as an FDR Democrat in the 1930s and 40s. In fact, he even campaigned for Truman in the late 1940s. He even was one of the founding members of the American Veterans Committee after World War II, which was the most progressive veterans organization ever in American history, up until perhaps Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Well, anyhow, so Ronald Reagan regularly faced defeat as a presidential candidate until, of course, he secures the nomination in 1980, and he runs for president. And what's interesting is in the course of his presidency, he does what he can to speak well of what we came to call the greatest generation. But when he spoke of them and how he needed to remember what they were about, he really was more often trying to suppress the memory of all that they accomplished as a generation. And then the high point, or maybe low point, of his rhetorical activity was first in 1987 at the Jefferson Memorial, at an event sponsored by, this is July 4th, 1987. He spoke of his desire to create Four Freedoms, which literally turned FDR's Four Freedoms on their head. Mm. And then in his famous farewell address of 1989, January, Reagan emphasizes the importance of teaching American history and sustaining American memory. And then he has the audacity, and this is exactly what you said, to say, we need to remind our fellow Americans that history is about freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of worship. And you're waiting for the next two words? No. He says, freedom of enterprise. And he literally expunges freedom from want and freedom from fear from the record.
Ooh. And somebody did, you write, a monument in Indiana where they left off one of the freedoms,
yeah,
right? Or they changed
it's, southern Evansville, Indiana.
Yeah.
And they have a Four Freedoms monument there, which is fabulous that they put one up. But instead of freedom from want, as a Cold War attitude that prevailed, I guess, the city fathers and mothers decided to name that freedom from oppression, which is a nice ideal. But I think freedom from fear would have covered that, and they dropped freedom from want. You know, ever since the Second World War, there are those who have gone out of their way. They've expended great sums of money to try to suppress the memory of the Four Freedoms, that the greatest generation fought not simply to defend the United States, not simply to protect what we're about, but to guarantee that we will advance those Four Freedoms. I can't tell you the generation believed they were going to accomplish it worldwide, as Roosevelt sometimes spoke, but they definitely believed they were going to make it happen in this country. And they did, as a matter of fact. But there were those who they had to fight every step of the way. And I think for the past 40 years, that every step of the way has been reversed, and we're backing up and backing up, and soon we'll be up against a wall.
Harvey Kay is our guest this hour. His new book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. We thought we have to pause for a moment, but going into the pause, we thought that how often are you going to have a chance? Maybe the problem is we don't hear this speech very much. More people like Harvey need to keep the Four Freedoms alive. This is FDR in January of 1941, enunciating the Four Freedoms. We'll welcome more of your phone calls. Willem, thanks for yours. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the future days which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy, peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
We're talking about the Four Freedoms and the Greatest Generation. Harvey Kaye is our guest. Harvey has been with us before talking mostly about Thomas Paine. He's written a fabulous book on Thomas Paine. The latest book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And let's go to an email here, Harvey. Helen from Madison says, please address the issue of the profound change in the way we respond to crises in the world today. After the shirtwaist factory fire where 37 workers were killed, we instituted reforms to protect workers from fires and the inability to escape from building disasters. After Bangladesh, where 1,000 people were killed, the companies involved in the factories hired expensive law firms to escape liability. That's what concerns me today, that many will never be held responsible and workers will continue to suffer and die.
It seems to me that we expend a lot of energy watching TV and emoting from our couches and chairs. But I think the other thing is that we need leaders who are going to invite us to turn out. In other words, I think... You know, it's our fault as well that we sit and we worry and we express a lot of angst. But it's also the case when we choose our leaders, we ought to choose leaders who don't make us comfortable, but who we know that are going to challenge us. They're going to speak to us as Americans, going to speak to us as fellow Americans, as fellow citizens. You know, and that I want to say something in relation to that, because crises. I mean, we've had our crises in Wisconsin of a decidedly political nature. And it struck me that as we confronted the question of public employees' rights, that we were sort of abandoned by our National Democratic Party. You know, I think back to Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt had a certain problem of mobility because of his disability. But you can be assured that in the 1930s, if we confronted that kind of moment, that Eleanor Roosevelt would have been here. And I, you know, we all marched around the Capitol. We know that 100,000 and more of us turned out to express ourselves. And the question isn't whether in the end we won or lost. That we'll fight again. The question is, where were those folks who we sent off to Washington as our national leaders? Where were they, okay, to keep the eye of the nation on our struggle? That's the question I would ask.
Let's go to Kevin in Green Bay. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for mentioning Harvey, one of our favorite places in Green Bay, Pamperin Park. I had an observation and then a question for you. I think that we would probably, if we sat down and talked for several hours, we may not come to agreement on a lot of things, me as a decided conservative and you as a decided liberal. But the one thing that I think that we would agree on is that there were two very tall standing presidents, the two tallest standing presidents of the 20th century, easily would have been Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. Now, that's just in terms of the political trajectory or where they got to. Obviously, Kennedy never had a chance to reach the heights he could have, and some others could be mentioned in there, but those two were the towering figures in terms of presidents of the 20th century. The question that I would have for you is, why so many of the people who grew up in that Depression era and under the policies of FDR later in their lives, so many of those people became what has been labeled as the Reagan Democrats?
All right.
I hate to disappoint you, but if you look closely at who the Reagan Democrats were, they actually were not the folks of the Greatest Generation. The folks of the Greatest Generation did not abandon the Democratic Party. The Reagan Democrats, though they included many of their number, the Reagan Democrats tended to be younger working people, not older working people. There's a, again, I can't remember the article. I'm in Green Bay. If you want to contact me locally, just do so, and I'll try to come up with the reference for you. But it is the case that the older generation of Democrats did not abandon the FDR tradition. And one other thing, so that should we ever get together at some afternoon for a few hours to argue, is no, I don't think Ronald Reagan is the one of the two towering figures of the 20th century. I have no doubt. I mean, historians will treat him as a transformative figure politically. His impact cannot be denied. But actually, Roosevelt towers so far above Reagan, in my opinion, given the numbers of people whose lives he enhanced by his policies and who the Americans he engaged in the process, that there's no other president probably in American history in those terms. Washington and Lincoln would be the closest alongside of him. The other figure of the 20th century who ends up a terribly tragic figure but who had the possibilities of standing alongside Roosevelt was probably Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson's ambitions were to become another Roosevelt. The problem was that he placed a war in Southeast Asia above a war on poverty at home.
Thanks, Kevin, for your call. Earl in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi, great show. My grandpa, many years ago, would put me on his knee and say, Earl, President Roosevelt cares for the little guy, not just the big shot. And I'm wondering if that's a general saying at that time, or did my grandpa just get that on his own?
Did you believe your grandpa, Earl?
I believe every word he says.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of being on Bill Moyer's show again a couple of weeks ago. And Bill said exactly the same thing to me. His father, on the day Roosevelt died, left his truck at the depot. His father had been a hard working farmer who was lost to any land he had access to, and became a truck driver. Got lucky enough to drive a truck. And at the end of the war, when Roosevelt passed away, his father came home, came in the house, and wept. Mm. Bill says, and why did he weep? He says because that was the one president who you knew was fighting on your side, on your side. I can also tell you this Friday evening I'm giving a memorial address.
Oh, yeah, let me mention
that. At UW Marathon County in memory of a great historian who taught there named Jim Lawrence. And Jim had sent me emails in the last couple of years before he passed away. As I was writing this book, he and I talked a lot, and he said, you know, Harvey, anyone who denies Franklin Roosevelt's place in history, they would need to talk to my parents, my grandparents, and all that they accomplished together.
Mm-hmm. And you're also, I meant to mention, that you're at Turner Hall, too.
On Tuesday evening, May 27th, coming down to speak at Turner Hall here in Milwaukee. Should be a great time. Turner Hall, classic German-American center. I'll also tell you that one of the reasons I love Turner Hall is because throughout the second half of the 19th century, right up until the 1920s, every year, they had the largest Thomas Paine birthday party in the United States. So it's a pleasure to turn up at Turner Hall as often as I can.
Great. We'll put that on our Facebook page, too, the Kathleen Dunn Show, so you know where Harvey will be speaking. Finally, we only have about a little over a minute left, if that. I wore my dad's Navy World War II pin, and you were talking a little bit about your father. There is something, because we're not young chickens anymore,
right,
that it's a good idea to remember this generation. We make of them lightly, but there were substantial things that we can learn and that we need to remember, as you remind us at the beginning of your book about your dad.
It's only
people.
It's only a few weeks away. My father was a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, received a Purple Heart. He drove a tank. Mm. Long story, I won't tell it here. But 10 years ago this spring, we unveiled the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans promised not to forget, not to forsake all that that generation accomplished. Well, I think we've forgotten, and I hope we don't forsake. We're at a critical moment in American history. We not only need to remember, we need to act. We cannot waste our history.
Thank you, Harvey, so much for being with us. Harvey Kaye, the book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Harvey, if you haven't read his book on Thomas Paine, it's just terrific. And it was a big hit of a show for us. Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. He's a frequent contributor to Huffington Post and the Daily Beast. And as he said, he was on the Bill Moyers show. go to our Facebook page for his upcoming presentations, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're with you again tomorrow. We're going to be talking about sexual assault on campuses, the second hour of our show, and the first hour of our show is going to be absolutely fascinating. I'm just not sure at the moment what it is. I'm still involved in FDR. That's where my mind is at the moment. Great conversations are coming up. Thanks, everybody, so much for listening. Again, happy Earth Day to you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.